Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're embarking on a fascinating and I think often surprising trip through the expansive career of Eric Idle.
Right.
Actor, comedian, songwriter, playwright. And, you know, everyone knows him as a key member of the team that completely redefined humor.
Monty Python, of course.
But what we're going to see is that his story is really about the triumphs and, well, the occasional pain of a truly independent mind trying to work inside and outside of a group framework.
That's absolutely right. I mean, when you look at Eric Idle's list of credits, it's just an astonishing creative output, active from, what, the late 1960s right up to today.
It's a huge career.
So our mission for this deep dive is to really trace the evolution of that singular comic voice.
Mm.
We're trying to pull apart this huge catalog, looking for those essential nuggets of insight that define his resilience and, as you said, his independent spirit.
And we'll be going from his difficult, very academic childhood through the internal dynamics of Python,
all the way up to his massive, lasting success on the stage with things like Spamalot.
And we've got comprehensive source material that's going to let us connect those dots. Everything from his early kind of traumatic influences, his distinct role within Python,
all the way through to his recent and very candid revelations about his finances and his relationships with his old colleagues.
It's a full picture of a very complicated man.
It is, and it's a story that's just defined by paradox.
And there's no greater paradox than his signature piece, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. I mean, that tune, written for a mass crucifixion scene.
In Life of Brian, yeah.
It somehow transcended its deeply cynical origins.
It's truly amazing. This is an anthem of forced persistence, a deeply, deeply cynical song, yet it became a genuine cultural touchstone. It gets played at memorial services, major sporting events.
He performed it at the London Olympics closing ceremony.
Exactly. I mean, it's massive success years after it first came out that really symbolizes Idle's entire career. Taking something dark and transforming it into something infectious and somehow surprisingly enduring.
That's a perfect framing device. So let's unpack this. To really understand how that voice developed, we have to start not with the laughs, but with the specific, harsh environment that ironically prepared him perfectly for a life of comedy.
So Idle was born in South Shields, that's in northern England,
yeah,
on March 29th, 1943. But his geographical origins, they really took a back seat almost immediately to this profound personal tragedy that hit the family.
And this tragedy wasn't a slow, expected event. It was sudden and crushing, and it really did define his early years. Can you walk us through that specific detail from the sources?
Certainly. His father, Ernest Idle, served as an aircraft fitter in the Royal Air Force during World War II. He had survived the entire war.
He made it through.
He made it through, but tragedy struck in December 1945. Ernest was killed in a road accident while he was hitchhiking home for Christmas. He was only 36 years old.
Wow. And the sources mention the gravestone inscription, and it holds so much of that forced optimism we were just talking about.
It speaks volumes, doesn't it? The inscription reads, "Say not good night, but in some fairer clime, good morning."
That's a sentiment designed to mitigate an unbearable loss.
Exactly. It's trying to force a positive, almost poetic interpretation onto a sudden, brutal reality. And that coping mechanism, cynicism, overlaid with a kind of forced cheer, that's a pattern we'll see again and again in his career.
And the sources confirm the profound impact this had on his mother, Nora Baron Sanderson, who was a nurse.
Oh, yes. She struggled significantly with the grief. The accounts say she disappeared for a while into depression, which left young Eric to be raised primarily by his grandmother in Swinton, Lancashire. He also spent time in Wallasey, Cheshire.
So a very fractured, unstable upbringing.
Very. And it reached this critical point when he was just 7 years old.
That's when he was enrolled as a boarder in the Royal Wolverhampton School. And the reasons for this, while maybe practical for his mother, established the formative environment for his comedy.
The Royal Wolverhampton School was a charitable foundation set up to educate and maintain children who had lost a parent. Now, on paper, that sounds like a helping hand.
It sounds supportive.
Right. But in reality, Idle described his experience there in, well, in stark terms. He characterized the school as a physically abusive, bullying, harsh environment.
That sounds utterly brutal for a seven-year-old. I mean, how does a child survive that kind of atmosphere? And what do the sources suggest about how that trauma translated into his eventual comedic voice?
And this is the first critical insight. Idle himself noted, almost with a kind of dark humor, that this harsh experience was perfect training for Python.
Perfect training for Python.
What he meant was that he learned essential survival skills. In a place where physical abuse and bullying were the norm, you couldn't fight back physically. your only defense was wit.
So you had to be clever.
You had to be smart and funny and subversive at the expense of authority. It's the ultimate defense mechanism. Using language, speed, and cleverness to undermine the power structure without ever engaging them on their own terms.
So comedy wasn't just an artistic pursuit for him. It was a deeply ingrained survival technique, honed over years and years of necessity. It allowed him to bond with others and target those figures of arbitrary power that defined his childhood.
Exactly. I mean, the targets of Python, comedy stuffy authority figures, bureaucratic nonsense, the arbitrariness of rules, these were the very people he had to evade and satirize just to get through his school day.
It sounds like an unbearable environment, and yet he thrived academically.
He did. But that success was rooted in necessity and, surprisingly, boredom. He pointed to only two bearable things about school life. Listening to Radio Luxembourg, often secretly under the bedclothes.
A classic.
And watching the local football team, the Wolverhampton Wanderers. Beyond those simple escapes, he just studied relentlessly, not necessarily out of passion, but because he was bored. This diligence is what won him a place at Cambridge University to study English at Pembroke College.
But that intellectual success, it didn't domesticate his rebellious streak, did it? We have a couple of excellent anecdotes that show his early, politically motivated subversion was fully intact even as he was getting all this academic recognition.
Oh, he was a highly decorated student head boy, excellent grades, but he was a natural dissident. There's the story about his weekly ritual, sneaking out of school every Thursday afternoon to go to the cinema.
And he got caught.
He got caught watching Butterfield 8, which was rated 16 and over. And because he was the head boy, this offense was seen as, you know, this unforgivable subversion of the rules. He was promptly stripped of his prefecture.
And it wasn't just youthful mischief. There was a serious political conscience there, too.
Absolutely. He refused to be the senior boy in the school cadet force because he was an ardent supporter of the campaign for nuclear disarmament.
CND.
He had even participated in the famous Aldermaston March. This wasn't a flippant refusal. It was a deep-seated opposition to militarism and authority. It shows his subversion had a strong moral and political grounding years before he ever met the other Pythons.
And all that smart, restless, subversive energy eventually found its focus at the famous Cambridge Footlights Club.
The Footlights was the crucial stepping stone. He was invited to join the prestigious club by the president, Tim Brooke Taylor, and Bill Oddie. Idle quickly became a driving force, eventually taking over as president himself in 1965.
And this is where he really found his people.
He found peers who valued intellectual wit over physical discipline, for sure.
And he holds an important historical detail related to the club's structure.
Yes. Idle was the first Footlights president who allowed women to join the club, which speaks to his progressive outlook and his willingness to break with institutional tradition, even in something as, you know, seemingly lighthearted as a university comedy society.
And this period immediately led to his professional collaborations. He was quickly moving in the right circles.
Precisely. His work at Footlights led him to join Do Not Adjust Your Set, which brought him together with future Python members Terry Jones and Michael Palin.
And Terry Gilliam was doing the animations?
Gilliam providing the iconic animations, yes. And crucially, he also appeared in At Last, the 1948 show, which featured both John Cleese and Graham Chapman. So by 1969, the foundations were perfectly laid. All these men knew each other, and Idle had refined his unique, independent comic style.
Which brings us right to the internal dynamics of Monty Python. Because when they all finally came together, Idle's independent path immediately established him as, well, an outlier within a very collaborative structure.
When Monty Python formed, they established this famously unique writing process, where the writing was primarily done in pairs. You had Cleese and Chapman and Palin and Jones. This was kind of the established dynamic of British comedy at the time.
But Idle chose a different path.
He wrote mostly by himself at his own pace.
What does the source material suggest was the thinking behind that isolation? Was it a conscious choice to protect his unique voice or just a byproduct of his independent upbringing?
It seems to be a combination of both. I mean, having survived school and then successfully navigated university and early television entirely on his own wit, he was reluctant to dilute his ideas through collaboration.
But that must have created problems.
It did. The problem, as Idle later described, was that while this independence allowed his singular voice to flourish, it created structural difficulties when it came to getting his material past the group.
That seems like an inherent flaw, doesn't it? If the writing process is designed around partnerships, the lone wolf is always going to be at a disadvantage.
And that's exactly what happened. In fact, Cleese himself admitted that the arrangement was slightly unfair. When the Pythons chose sketches, Idle, despite having written an entire segment by himself, only got one vote.
Just one vote, same as the combined writing pairs.
Exactly.
And Idle perfectly captured that internal tension. He said, "You had to convince five others." And they were not the most unegotistical of writers either.
Right. It paints a picture of intense intellectual and creative competition.
It suggests that his success within Python was really hard won. He had to fight for every single word he wrote, forcing the others to accept a voice that was fundamentally different from theirs.
It was. While the Cleese Chapman sketches often focused on, you know, the disintegration of formal logic, and Palin Jones explored the world of ordinary characters gone strange, Idle carved out his own niche with language itself.
Let's discuss that Hallmark style, his obsession with communication and the mechanics of language.
His work is just dominated by linguistic games. He focused on characters whose defining trait was some verbal peculiarity. We're talking about the man who speaks entirely in anagrams, a joke based purely on structure and vocabulary.
Or the man who constantly says words in the wrong order.
Right, creating dissonance just through syntax. And then there were the monologues.
The dreaded monologue. He was the king of the extended rambling monologue.
Absolutely. Think of the travel agency sketch customer who walks in and just delivers this massive, detailed, and increasingly horrific recounting of his holiday experiences without ever letting anyone else speak. Idle was brilliant at taking an idea and just letting the character run with it, using sheer verbosity to overwhelm you.
But you mentioned his mastery of insincere characters. How does that connect to the verbal peculiarities?
It connects because the language used by these characters is often unnatural, it's overly formal, or it's just simply unbelievable. These are people desperately trying to maintain appearances or deny reality.
Right.
Consider the criminal Stigo Tracy trying to deny that Dinsdale Piranha nailed his head to the floor. The refusal to acknowledge the physical fact, instead deflecting it through insincere criminal doublespeak, is vintage Idle.
And another great example is the David Frost-esque Timmy Williams.
A figure of just superficial, empty pleasantries that hide a complete lack of substance.
He was definitely the Python member most attuned to the new generation of media figures and the specific stylized language they used.
Well, he was the second youngest member and arguably the most modern in his reference points. His time working on TV before Python allowed him to spot and spoof the unnatural speech patterns of television presenters and commercialism.
And that connection meant his sketches often dealt with contemporary obsessions.
Exactly. The things that appealed most directly to the younger audience. Pop music, sexual permissiveness, and recreational drugs, often characterized by pervasive double entendres and references the team just labeled as naughty.
Which brings us to the sketch that exemplifies this entire style, Nudge Nudge. Can we unpack that story and why it's so definitive of his work?
It's crucial. Nudge Nudge relies entirely on inference, innuendo, and double entendre. Uses coded language and winks without ever explicitly delivering a punchline. The humor is all in the implication and the nervous energy of the speaker. It's an exercise in saying everything without saying anything.
And the origin story is fantastic.
It really highlights the difference between Idle's high-concept humor and the traditional British comedy of the time. Idle originally wrote the sketch for the legendary Ronnie Barker.
Wow.
Who immediately rejected it. And Barker's critique was devastatingly simple. He felt it had no joke in the words.
No joke in the words.
But Idle was proving that the joke wasn't in the literal words. It was in the unspoken, implied context that the audience was forced to fill in. It was a joke about communication failure, masking illicit topics. It was subversive to its core.
So his independence wasn't just in his writing schedule. It was in his entire comedic philosophy.
Absolutely. And that independence also allowed him to introduce a huge amount of music into the show. He was a talented guitarist and composer, responsible for writing and performing many of the famous Python musical numbers.
So what are some of his most significant compositions within the Python canon?
Well, besides the obvious one, we have the philosophical and cosmological Galaxy Song, which provided this whimsical existential counterpoint to the seriousness of the meaning of life.
Right.
Then there's the utterly ridiculous Eric the Half a Bee from the previous record album, which is a perfect example of his nonsensical whimsy. His musicality allowed him to insert these complete, polished, and often highly complicated standalone pieces of satire directly into the group's output.
And then the piece that cemented his musical legacy, Always Look on the Bright Side of Life.
It's the ultimate expression of his subversive wit. The sources note it has become the Python signature tune, performed during that famously grim mass crucifixion scene in Life of Brian. It takes the most hopeless scenario imaginable, imminent, painful death, and applies the most irritatingly cheerful English stoicism to it. It's not optimistic. It's a satire of forced optimism.
And that subversive energy didn't stop when Flying Circus ended. He didn't slow down. He immediately channeled that unique, independent energy into new projects, defining his post-Python identity very quickly.
Once Flying Circus wrapped up, the Pythons had to navigate that difficult transition to solo careers. And Idol was arguably the most prolific and the quickest to establish a new, fully independent comedic platform, maintaining that same level of creative control he cherished.
His first move was into BBC Radio 1 with his own show, Radio 5, which ran from 1973 to 1974.
And here we see that insistence on independence again. For Radio 5, he performed nearly all the multi-tracked parts himself.
That's a huge amount of work.
It is, but it means the final product was entirely his vision, unfiltered. And this dedication to self-sufficiency led directly into his next television venture, Rutland Weekend Television, or RWT.
Right, running from 1975 to 1976 on BBC Two, with music provided by Neil Innes.
Yes, and the premise of RWT is a perfect example of Idol's penchant for layered, highly specific internal satire.
It's classic British media satire.
Totally. RWT was explicitly set up as a parody of London Weekend Television, which is the commercial franchise contractor for ITV in London. But Idol took it several layers deeper.
Okay, break that down.
The show's joke was that RWT was Britain's smallest television network. And that joke was enhanced because Rutland was England's smallest county, which had just recently been abolished in an administrative shakeup.
So it's a very in-joke.
Very. And finally, the show itself ironically aired on a weekday, undercutting the weekend television title. Its satire requiring deep institutional and geographical knowledge, which is pure Idol.
And the program gained enough cultural cachet to attract a very, very famous guest.
Indeed. George Harrison, a massive Python fan, made an appearance on one episode. And this connection was foundational because the collaboration between Idol and Neil Innes on RWT led to Idol's first major post-Python international success.
The Ruttles.
The Ruttles.
The ultimate affectionate parody of the Beatles, often called the Prefab Four. How did this very British parody explode into the American consciousness?
That's where his independent career really flourished due to his visibility in the U.S. Idol was invited to host Saturday Night Live four times between 76 and 79.
So he became a familiar face?
A familiar, trusted face, and American audiences just embraced this kind of detailed, knowing musical satire that blended absurdity with reality.
And that popularity led to the 1978 mockumentary, All You Need Is Cash.
A definitive early example of the mockumentary format, really. Idol wrote and directed it, starring as Dirk McQuickley, the Paul McCartney character, while also acting as the main commentator. And it brought together the Python world and the burgeoning SNL world.
Right, with John Belushi, Bill Murray, Gilda Radner.
And Michael Palin. It felt like a true cultural crossover event.
The fact that actual music legends participated confirms how seriously, or maybe how affectionately, the joke was taken.
Absolutely. The sources note appearances by former Beatle George Harrison, Mick Jagger, and Paul Simon. I mean, when the targets of your satire volunteer to be in your film, you know you've struck gold. And the longevity is impressive, too. Idol revisited this creation in 2008, writing and directing Ruttlemania for the 30th anniversary.
Now, in his film career, we see a fascinating pattern emerging in the sources, a contrast between the success he had when directed by others and the failure of his own self-penned narrative projects.
This is a crucial distinction. He received positive critical notices when he was cast in the structured worlds of other directors. He was excellent as the whimsical ratty in Terry Jones' 1996 version of The Wind in the Willows.
And he got great reviews for The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Oh, yes, for his physical comedy as Berthold Desmond in Terry Gilliam's visually stunning film in 1989, and alongside Robbie Coltrane in the popular Nuns on the Run in 1990.
But the sources suggest his own attempts at traditional comedic screenwriting fell flat.
They did. Take his 1993 comedy film Splitting Hairs, which he wrote, starred in, and executive produced. It was largely unsuccessful both with critics and at the box office.
What does this pattern tell us about Idol's unique talent? Why did his independent, verbose brilliance translate perfectly into sketch comedy and musical parody, but fail in traditional cinematic narrative?
I think the sources suggest that his specific talent for linguistic satire and fragmented narrative, the very things that made Python great, just didn't suit the demands of a traditional feature film structure that required, you know, character development and plot coherence.
So the Ruttles worked because it was layered parody.
Exactly. And Splitting Hairs struggled because it was expected to be a straight comedic narrative. He needed either the structure of the ensemble, like Python, or the formal constraint of music or theater, which leads us right to his voice work.
That's a good link. When the traditional cinematic narrative didn't hold, he found a perfect outlet for his unique verbal eccentricities in the contained descriptive world of animation and voice work.
Precisely. He had a natural knack for the verbose, slightly oddball character that fits animation perfectly. He gave life to Wreck-Gar, the leader of the Junkies in the Transformers, the movie in 1986.
And that character's defining trait was pure idle.
Pure idle linguistic play. Wreck-Gar speaks only in catchphrases and slogans.
He also entered the world of fantasy gaming.
Yes. He voiced Rincewind the Wizard in the Discworld computer adventure games in the mid-90s. And he wasn't just lending his voice, he was deeply involved, composing the theme song, That's Death, for the sequel, proving his musical integration was vital to the work.
And for generations of fans, he's the familiar voice of a specific animated documentary filmmaker.
He is the voice of Declan Desmond,
yeah,
the jaded documentarian in four memorable appearances on The Simpsons, often providing the voice of cynical reason, which is perfect for Idol.
And he even ended up in Shrek.
He did. He provided the voice of Merlin in DreamWorks' Shrek III in 2007, where he was reunited with John Cleese, who voiced King Harold. He even narrated the audiobook of Roald Dahl's classic Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
We must also mention his willingness to appear in utterly unexpected venues, which really showcases his range. He tackled opera.
That's a true testament to his fearlessness. In 1987, he performed as Coco, the Lord High Executioner, in the English National Opera production of Gilbert and Sullivan's comic opera, The Mikado.
And in ultimate subversive idol fashion, he didn't stick to the original libretto entirely.
Not at all. He utilized the famous Little List song to insert his own topical comedic material, proving he could satirize even high culture from within.
And he secured a lasting place in theme park history, playing a character that millions of tourists saw daily.
That's Dr. Nigel Channing, the chairman of the Imagination Institute. He played this character in the highly popular theme park attractions, Honey, I Shrunk the Audience, at both Epcot and Disneyland.
And later for the Journey into Imagination with Figment Ride at Epcot.
Right. And he also starred in and wrote the 3D film Pirates 4D. This whole period demonstrates that his greatest skill was adapting the Python-esque brand of absurd, contained comedy into any format that was presented to him.
This diverse output shows his willingness to move beyond traditional Hollywood structures, but his greatest financial and critical success would ultimately come from embracing and adapting the Python mythology on stage, proving the stage was his true sweet spot.
After years of diversified projects, Idol consciously stepped into the role of the most active standard bearer for the Python brand. He recognized the value of that shared legacy and its capacity to engage new audiences in a live setting.
He toured extensively in the early 2000s, performing Python songs and post-Python material. He had the Eric Idle Exploits Monty Python tour and the more notorious The Greedy Bastard tour.
And the naming of that latter tour, The Greedy Bastard tour, is a classic example of Idle undercutting his own commercial endeavor with self-satire. The tour of 2003 was highly successful and was documented in the book The Greedy Bastard Diary. This really established him as the de facto keeper of the Python flame.
But the culmination of this entire stage-focused chapter, the project that gave him both critical immortality and massive financial stability, was Spamalot.
Spamalot, the musical comedy based on Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which debuted in 2004, was a monumental success. And this project perfectly utilized his skill set. He wrote both the book and the lyrics, collaborating with John Duprez on the music.
It worked because it took the fragmented, non-linear humor of the film and placed it within the controlled musical structure of Broadway.
Which demands energy and timing over plot coherence, yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like the musical format was the perfect constraint for his creativity, something he lacked when writing traditional film narratives. The accolades just confirm the cultural impact.
They certainly do. The original 2005 Broadway production secured the Tony Award for Best Musical and a Grammy for Best Musical Theater Album. And crucially, Idol himself won the Drama Desk Award for Outstanding Lyrics.
This confirmed his status as a master lyricist and dramatist, independent of that original five-man Python vote dynamic. And that success is ongoing. In 2020, he announced he would adapt his successful Spamalot script into a feature film.
And he didn't stop with Holy Grail. He revisited the other great Python film, Life of Brian, in a highly unusual format.
Yes, that led to Not the Messiah, which is a comic oratorio written by Idle and Duprez,
yeah,
which premiered in 2007.
Which is an insane concept.
It is. A classical music structure, an oratorio, typically reserved for religious narratives, used to satirize the most controversial religious satire in cinematic history.
And he was right there, performing it live.
He performed live alongside the Toronto Symphony Orchestra and the Toronto Mendelssohn Choir. The show was a massive success, later revised and expanded for a global tour, including sellout nights at the Sydney Opera House. It shows his enduring appeal to blend highbrow form with lowbrow, brilliant comedy.
Shifting back to his musical legacy, Idol has about 150 songs to his credit, including the Philosopher's Song and the deliberately crude Penis Song. But the conversation always, always returns to always look on the bright side of life.
It has this undeniable cultural force. We saw two high-profile global showcases of the song years after its initial debut, cementing its place in popular culture.
He performed it at the London 2012 Summer Olympics closing ceremony, a huge global moment. And it served as the emotional, high-profile farewell song of the final Python reunion show, Monty Python Live, mostly.
At the O2 Arena in July 2014, yeah. And we should note that Idol wasn't just a performer in that reunion. He created and directed the entire show, underscoring his key role in managing the logistics and creative presentation of the Python brand in the 21st century.
It's still fascinating that Brightside wasn't an immediate success. The story of its chart ascension is a great anecdote about cultural timing and coincidence.
It truly is. The song hit number 3 in the UK charts in October 1991, fully 12 years after Life of Brian.
12 years later.
And the sources attribute this renaissance to his then neighbor, the famous footballer Gary Lineker, who suggested Idol re-record and release the track. It then gained massive traction when BBC Radio 1 breakfast show host Simon Mayo started frequently playing it.
And because it was such a massive, unexpected hit, it forced a necessary adaptation for daytime radio play.
Yes, the classic line, "Life's a piece of shit," had to be modified. For daytime radio airplay, the line became, "Life's a piece of spit." This small, seemingly innocuous change allowed the song to reach a huge mainstream audience and achieve commercial success it otherwise wouldn't have.
It's amazing that a song born out of bitter cynicism had to be sort of whitewashed for mainstream success. Does the source material suggest that that necessary change, that compromise, in any way tainted the artistic integrity of the original piece for him?
Idol has often viewed commercial success with a degree of healthy cynicism, so I think he saw it as part of the joke. It was a commentary on the absurdity of media censorship. In fact, he channeled that very frustration into another brilliant protest song later on.
That would be the FCC song.
Correct. The Federal Communications Commission, the SEC, had fined him $5,000 for using the word fuck on national radio. And Idol's response was characteristically rebellious. He wrote the SEC song in 2004, a piece specifically designed to lambast the commission, and he intentionally included 14 uses of the forbidden word.
Turning the song itself into a protest.
Exactly. A highly publicized satirical protest against arbitrary broadcast standards.
This relentless independence and willingness to fight authority, which we traced back to the Royal Wolverhampton School, is fully present in his 80s. But here's where we need to address the recent personal details that put a new spin on his relationship with his legacy and his former colleagues.
Idol has maintained a complex private life. He was married first to actress Lynn Ashley from 1969 to 1975, and they have one son, Kerry. He then married Tanya Kulcevich, a former model, in 1981, and they have a daughter, Lily.
His friendships are certainly high caliber, cementing his position within the creative elite.
They are. He's a first cousin of the Canadian conductor Peter Ungine, but most famously, he was a close friend of David Bowie, who made Idol the godfather to his son, the film director Duncan Jones.
And he's lived in the U.S. for a long time.
Yes, he's held permanent residencies since around 1997, where he lived for many years in the Hollywood Hills.
That Hollywood Hills mansion became symbolic of his success, but recent financial disclosures complicate that image.
They do. In 2023, he sold his large 5-bedroom, 7,000-square-foot mansion. And according to sources, this decision was necessitated by financial difficulty. This financial stress brings into sharp relief the conversation he had around his health and career longevity.
On the health front, he revealed a very serious diagnosis he had kept private for years.
In 2019, he was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Fortunately, it was caught incredibly early, and he underwent successful surgery to remove the tumor, requiring no further treatment.
And he kept this private for a while.
He did, until 2022, when he made the revelation publicly while competing on season 8 of The Masked Singer as the Hedgehog.
Competing on The Masked Singer is an unexpected career choice for a comedy icon, but that environment gave us a wonderful anecdote about his relationship with one of his musical heroes.
The Paul McCartney story is perfect. Idol needed approval from McCartney to cover Love Me Do for the competition, and Idol shared that he secured the approval in exchange for a simple promise. He had to tell McCartney what the Masked Singer competition actually was.
What it was.
He noted that McCartney wanted to know so he could avoid it at all costs. A classic piece of comedic exchange between two legends.
In terms of his worldview, he identifies as an atheist, but in classic Idol style, he even approaches that term with skepticism.
He dislikes the term itself, stating it implies there's a God not to believe in. It's another example of him questioning the structural assumptions built into everyday language.
And he's pretty candid about his media habits.
As of 2025, yes. He says he watches very little, avoiding news, newspapers, and contemporary movies because he finds them very boring and for 12-year-olds. He prefers Netflix thrillers, demonstrating his ongoing habit of curating his own reality, isolated from the noise.
But the biggest headlines related to Idol in 2024 and 2025 revolved around the severity of his financial state and, perhaps more painfully, his now fractured relationships with the surviving Pythons.
This is a complex situation that shocked many fans. In February 2024, Idol revealed he was still working at age 80, primarily for financial reasons. He gave a particularly blunt quote calling Python a disaster, citing that the income streams had tailed off so disastrously.
That's a stark statement for one of the authors of such a global success story. But he immediately followed it with that classic Idol resilience.
Yes. He immediately undercut the tragedy by stating, I don't mind not being wealthy. I prefer being funny. That statement perfectly encapsulates the tension that has run through his entire career, the conflict between commercial success and independent creative integrity.
But the need to work into his ninth decade underscores that the financial strain is very real.
Very real. And he's been remarkably blunt about the group dynamics. The independent voice is now totally isolated.
It's sad.
It is. In an interview in July 2025, he stated his relationship with the other surviving Pythons was poor to terrible. He elaborated that they don't talk to me. I haven't seen them for 10 years.
That's devastating, especially considering the camaraderie they presented to the public for decades. The individual voice that struggled for a single vote back in part two is now entirely cut off from the collaborative structure that made him famous.
It creates a potent final irony. The very independence that allowed him to create Spamalot and tour successfully is now manifesting as isolation in his personal life. Despite this, his career push continues. His first solo UK tour since 1973 was organized for later in 2025.
And his political edge remains sharp.
Oh, yeah. During a Q&A session, he was strongly critical of Donald Trump, stating he would be proud to be thrown out of the U.S., referencing the historical precedent of Charlie Chaplin, who was, as Idol noted, the last English comedian thrown out for political reasons.
Finally, we have to mention the unique tributes to his enduring cultural impact, spanning both the celestial and the digital.
An asteroid, 9620 Eris Idol, is named in his honor, a cosmic acknowledgement of his lasting influence. And in the digital realm, the Integrated Development Environment, or IDE, of the programming language Python is called IDLE.
A direct reference.
Chosen specifically in allusion to him, just as the language itself is named after Monty Python, his influence is literally coded into global technology.
So if we look back at Eric Idle's incredible decades-long journey, we see a transition forged by immense pressure, a difficult, disciplined, and often harsh upbringing, which he described with that signature cynical twist as perfect training for Python.
And that background created the most self-sufficient, verbose, and independent voice in the group.
His story is a masterclass in independent spirit. He worked best alone, which created intense internal conflict within Python, but it also enabled his greatest solo triumphs, particularly his financially and critically dominant songwriting and theatrical adaptations like Spamalot.
He remains the active standard bearer for the legacy, yet he is now managing a deeply complicated and increasingly distant relationship with the group he helped create, consciously choosing creative freedom over passive wealth.
We saw that Idol felt his difficult childhood was the perfect training for Python, preparing him for harsh, challenging environments. Given the very real, very public financial and relational stresses he has shared in his 80s, the very real pain of losing wealth and connection, we have to ask, what fundamental, perhaps necessary relationship does the comedian have with pain?
Yeah.
And does comedy, especially the kind of cynical, survival-based wit that Idol perfected, always require that tension, that inherent conflict, to continue to produce bright sides for the rest of us? Something for you to mull over as you contemplate the persistent nature of comedic genius.
Absolutely.
We'll catch you next time for the deep dive.